All right, Erev Tov once again. Welcome to the Present and the Jews, Part 15. Tonight we're discussing the presidencies of Warren G. Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover, sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Le'ili Nishmas Yonah, Ben Reb Aryeh Leib. So the Roaring Twenties began amid great hope and excitement, as World War I did usher in the American century. Europe's wars were behind us, and hopefully for good. America was prospering. It was an acknowledged world leader. And American culture began to make a powerful impact on society. Jazz and baseball, women wearing their flappers and smoking and voting. Drinking, prohibition made alcohol even more desirable. And the decadence of the era really presaged the 1960s and the decline of America today. And the America was served by three presidents during that era, 29, 30, and 31, who had all different personalities, and for decades all were judged very harshly and perhaps unfairly, because the end result was the Great Depression. So let's start with Harding, Warren Gamliel Harding, the long Republican era of political dominance was broken only by Woodrow Wilson and resumed with the election of Harding in 1920. The best that can be said of Harding always was that he looked presidential. He was tall, well-built, ladies' man, had a shock of gray hair on his head. Harding became the first senator to be elected president directly from the Senate. There have been only two others to date. JFK was the first, and of course Obama. And now you have three senators running for office as well. And Harding was an old school politician. He was kind. He was bright. He's not given credit for that, but he was. He was charismatic. And he basically looked to have a good time, which really fit him in with his era. He's been accused of filling the White House with alcohol, even though it was illegal, with gambling, he ran regular poker games, and with women. What he did in the Oval Office might make Bill Clinton blush. Now, Harding was married to Florence, but he was accused of fathering his only child out of wedlock with another woman. Florence herself actually had a child out of wedlock before they were married. And Harding at one time said of himself, "I am not fit for this office and never should have been here." A rare admission by any president. The Maharal notes at the beginning of Parshas Mishpatim that the occasional boor can also become the leader of a society. So how did he get there? And were these descriptions even true? And how did he become, Harding, the last Republican nominee for president ever to win the Jewish vote? That's right, Harding got a higher percentage of the Jewish vote than even Reagan did running against Jimmy Carter in 1980. Well, perhaps Warren Harding gets a worse rap than he deserves, and he's always ranked as one of the worst presidents, but his short tenure as president merits some scrutiny. So Harding was born in 1865 in Ohio. He was the last of the seven Ohio natives who served as president beginning in 1869, and there have been none since, until President Kasich is sworn in. Now, his middle name, Gamliel, or in English I think it's like Gamaliel, was an uncle. So where do they come to such a name? Well, we know of Rabbi Gamliel, the two Rabbi Gamliels in the Mishnah. Rabbi Gamliel HaZaken and Rabbi Gamliel de Yavne. So it turns out, I didn't know this till I did my research here, Rabbi Gamliel HaZaken is cited in the New Testament as advising his peers not to execute the apostles after Jesus was killed. So Gamliel is a symbol of good counsel, and Bible knowledgeable Christians use that name when, you know, the mood suited them. Both of Harding's parents were medical professionals. Father was a doctor. Mother wanted to go to medical school. She became a midwife, each with separate practices. And Harding never studied much, although he received good grades. He was a classic crammer before exams. He was a devoted son. But from college on, he sent his mother a bouquet of flowers every Sunday for his entire life, no matter where he was, and she died in 1910. His father actually outlived him. At a young age, Harding became a newspaper publisher in Marion, Ohio, and that's how he made his reputation. Harding became wealthy and successful, and in that capacity, he met a local girl in Marion named Florence Kling, who was the daughter of Marion's wealthiest businessman, Amos Kling, who, by strange coincidence, Harding had routinely denounced in his newspaper. It made for a very rocky relationship. Florence and her father never got along. She'd had a child out of wedlock after her father threw her out of his house just to spite him. And eventually her father decided to raise the child as his own if Florence would just move on. And move on she did. And to his horror, he married his young nemesis in town, Warren Harding. It's hard to characterize their marriage as a love affair. She was 5 years older, very demanding. He always called her the boss, and I didn't always mean it in a friendly way. She was as rigid as he was relaxed, and if he needed a break from her, he just traveled. And he did that throughout his life. It wasn't until 1907 that Amos Kling reconciled with his daughter and his son-in-law. And he died a few years after that. As a newspaper editor and as a Republican, Harding, before he was 30 years old, had already met William McKinley and Teddy Roosevelt and other notables. He also routinely received treatment in a sanitarium for some type of mental illness, a nervous breakdown. Some called it fatigue. Others argue that it was an undisclosed or undiagnosed heart condition that he had. In any event, Harding became a state senator in 1899, then lieutenant governor. Then he left politics to tend to his wife, who had taken ill. And then he began a long affair with his best friend's wife, Carrie Phillips, only revealed after Harding's death. Apparently Florence knew about it when the paramour attended a Harding campaign event in 1920, Florence threw a piano stool at her. Don't you wish you had television back in those days? In 1910, Harding lost the run for governor, but in 1914, he was elected to the United States Senate. There he was well respected for a number of reasons. He served on the Foreign Relations Committee, opposed the League of Nations. He routinely missed votes on controversial issues. And so he offended no one, shades of another senator who would become president also. He was a good sport, and he campaigned for colleagues, and he was a bombastic speaker. William McAdoo was Wilson's son-in-law, and I think Treasury Secretary also under Wilson, described Harding's speech as, I quote, "an army of pompous phrases moving over the landscape in search of an idea." I've heard others speak that way also. But by the way, Harding is the first president we can actually hear speak. If you search YouTube, Warren Harding, put in Warren Harding, League of Nations, and you'll hear a five-minute speech that he made in the Senate opposing the League of Nations, and it's exactly as McAdoo described it. You can't figure out what side he's on or what he's trying to say. So too, regarding women's suffrage and prohibition, the big issues when he was in the Senate, Harding was alternately on both sides of both issues, and so he found himself in a position to compete for the presidency in 1920. He had a strong appearance, calm demeanor, and a winning slogan for a nation that was tired of war and the recession that followed. Not heroics, but healing. Not nostrums, but normalcy. And his campaign became known by the shorthand, a return to normalcy, or back to normalcy. In another mantra, America first, before old world stabilization, as he called it. America first would then become a slogan that reverberates in American history for almost a century after. The Republican field was wide open because Teddy Roosevelt had announced 2 years earlier that he was running again for president in 1920. Alas, he died in 1919. leaving no natural successor. So Harding was defeated in every primary and was in sixth place after the first ballot at the Republican nominating convention, but in what would become a famous cliche, the party bosses met in a smoke-filled room and egged on by his campaign manager, Harry Daugherty, who became the Attorney General, Harding won the nomination on the 10th ballot. He was opposed by Ohio Governor James Cox, who chose as his running mate the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, a young New Yorker named Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was seen in pictures as tall, young, vibrant. He contracted polio less than a year after the election. Harding ran a front porch campaign, as McKinley had 20 years earlier, and he won in a landslide of 7 million votes, 60% to 34% for Cox. 43% of the Jews voted for Harding against only 19% for Cox. Well, where do the other Jewish votes go? 38% of Jews voted for the socialist Eugene V. Debs, who was still in prison, having been incarcerated by Woodrow Wilson for his opposition to the war. Debs appealed, and the Supreme Court upheld the Espionage Act under which he was convicted. So oddly, Debs could not vote for himself, as he had been stripped of the right to vote as a convicted felon. But he got 4% of the vote overall. 30% of the Jews, though, voted for him. Jews were drawn to Debs for reasons that would be incomprehensible today, but for the attraction of many people to Bernie Sanders. Now, many Jews of the time recoiled from nationalism because of our bad experiences with European nationalism, and Debs was unabashed. I quote, he said this during the war, "I have no country to fight for. My country is the earth, and I am a citizen of the world." Now, those slogans are attractive, even if they can never be implemented, and many Jews were enamored with him and his ideas. Again, remember the time, the 19-teens. Socialism, international brotherhood, universal equality, workers' rights, income redistribution, etc. Things in our lifetime we never thought we'd hear of again, but they've all been revived. Debs was charismatic and outspoken. I quote, "I would rather 1,000 times be a free soul in jail than to be a sycophant and coward in the streets. I may not be able to say all I think, but I'm not going to say anything I do not think." And Jews were largely not from the ownership class, but from the workers, and were heavily unionized. And so Jews were attracted to Debs, so attractive. That was the New York radio station, WEVD. Even though Debs wasn't Jewish, now the Jews felt an attachment to him. But consider this, the marginalization of the Jewish vote had its origins here. Like I said, Jews voted 38% for Debs, but Debs overall received less than 4% of the national vote. Since the election of 1920, Jews have always voted for the Democrat candidate, ranging from a high of 90% for Roosevelt twice, 90% for Johnson in 1964, to a low of 45% for Carter in 1980. But even then, Reagan received only 39% of the Jewish votes, the third party candidate that year. So the long Jewish love affair with the Democrats had begun, and its end is not yet in sight. So Harding benefited from war anger, really war fatigue. Who voted against him? Well, German Americans voted against the Democrats, as did Irish Americans. Germans because the Democrats had gone to war against Germany, and Irish Americans because of the alliance with Britain. So Harding threaded the needle on all controversial issues, not offending anybody, and so he took office. Now, within a year, Congress repealed the Espionage and Sedition Acts, in large part, and Harding himself commuted Debs' 10-year sentence to time served, and he was freed in late December 1921. Harding even gave him an audience in the White House. He said, come straight from prison to the White House. And he did, all by himself. He took a train from Georgia, where he's in prison, all the way to Washington. So for that alone, you'd think that Harding would attract at least some measure of sympathy from liberals, and less so for Wilson, who incarcerated him, but not so. Well, as president, Harding tried, and the truth is that his reputation was much better when he died in office than it was within a half decade later, after various scandals erupted. And he was a sharp contrast to the scholarly Wilson. But an argument can be made. I read a biography written about Harding by, of all people, John Dean, who was Nixon's counsel and got enmeshed in Watergate. So Dean writes that, according as he sees it, Harding was a successful president who died young, but was not judged kindly by tendentious historians because of what came after him. So, what in fact did Harding do? Most of his cabinet appointments were silent individuals. Charles Evans Hughes, Secretary of State, Andrew Mellon, the great financier, the Treasury Secretary, Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce, we'll get back to later. He cut taxes. He created the Budget Department. He brought in Charles Dawes to run it. Dawes would become Coolidge's vice president. Dawes cut the budget $1 billion in 1 year, which is a substantial part of the budget then. Harding favored the creation of a Department of Public Welfare that would oversee education, public health, workers' conditions, etc. Congress cut tariffs, not as much as Harding wanted, but they did. And it was Harding who realized that even though Republicans are pro-business, and the business community usually loves tariffs on foreign imports because that helps domestic industry, the world had changed. America's prosperity in the 1920s was rooted in exports, so other countries could retaliate if we had high tariffs here. And lost in all the condescension to the three Republican presidents of this decade, the Roaring Twenties were great for business and the people. Americans were well off. The economy was good. Harding vetoed a congressional bill that would have paid bonuses to World War I veterans. And we know, ad hayom, there's nothing cheaper than for a politician to drape themselves around the halo of veterans. You got to support the troops. But Harding outlined what the government had already done for veterans, and he saw no further justification in spending $100 million of the people's money to satisfy the demands of millions of veterans. It didn't make any sense to him. He tried to reverse Wilson's racist policies. Now, interestingly, rumors followed Harding his entire life that his great-grandmother was black. Rumors spread by his father-in-law to try to prevent his daughter from marrying Harding, and rumors spread in the crass and crude language of the time. These rumors surfaced every time Harding ran for office, including in 1920. But in office, Harding reached out. He met several times with the NAACP, appointed dozens of blacks to government positions. Again, a stark contrast to Woodrow Wilson, who had removed all blacks from any government service and appointed none. And he was stymied from appointing more only because Wilson had made those government appointees into civil servants who could not be fired. The origin of the government employees union that's been a Democrat stronghold ever since. Harding condemned lynching. He spoke in favor of black voting rights. Legislation in Congress was thwarted by Southern Democrats. Harding even traveled to Birmingham, Alabama in October 1921 and said to a white audience that the time had come for full political and economic equality of the races. No president would talk like that again for decades. And he said, I would say, let the black man vote when he is fit to vote. Prohibit the white man voting when he is unfit to vote. Whites in the audience sat stunned. Harding continued, whether you like it or not, unless our democracy is a lie, you must stand for that equality. He didn't have much more than perfunctory involvement with Jews, although he spoke highly of the Jewish people in a message he sent to the Reform Movement celebrating its 50th anniversary. And I quote, one of the marvels of humanity's story has been the strength and persistence of the Jewish faith and the continuing influence and power of the Jewish people. I cannot but feel that these things are in large measure owing to the Hebrew conception of a personal God and of the individual accountability of men and women. All true. Very nice thought. In 1921, Harding welcomed to Washington two Jewish dignitaries, Chaim Weizmann and Albert Einstein, who both came to raise money for Keren HaYesod. He awarded both prizes from the National Academy of the Sciences, and both also got keys to New York City. Since then, the locks have been changed. Now, Harding voted against Brandeis's confirmation, but Jews generally turned against Harding after Congress overwhelmingly passed even more restrictive immigration legislation in 1921. It didn't come from Harding, he enforced it, but the bill targeted mainly Italians and Jews. Now, he and the Secretary of Labor made thousands of exemptions. Harding, for example, dispatched Meyer Bloomfield, one of the pioneers of vocational training, is a Romanian-born Jew, grew up on the Lower East Side. He sent him to Europe to set up screening centers so potential immigrants didn't travel to the U.S. only to be turned away. Now, Jews blamed Harding, but there was a strong national consensus for the bill. The Senate voted 78-1, which is overwhelming, but thereafter Jewish immigration fell to a trickle. And something else happened as well. As I mentioned last week, Henry Ford's Dearborn Independent, which is he was an open Jew hater, and his organ, a Jew hating rag, soured the atmosphere. And that reflected the gentry Americans' resistance to the changes that immigrants, especially Jews, were bringing to the United States. Ford attacked the Jewish bankers, who themselves had little use for or interest in the Jewish immigrants. Ford also criticized the Jews in Hollywood for debasing the culture. Hollywood was about a decade old then, and that criticism remains until today. The greatest change, and all part of this, was the growing sense in Jewish life that Jews had already crashed into a ceiling of accomplishment and were now stymied. They could no longer go mobile upward. In the universities in the 1920s, an informal numerus clausus had taken root, closed number, meaning a quota of Jews that could be admitted, after which Jews would be summarily rejected regardless of their resumes. So, for example, in the 1910s, Jewish enrollment in Columbia was more than 25% of the student body. Harvard was close to a third of the student body. 10 years later, by the mid-1920s, after the quota was instituted, the numbers had dropped to around 14-15%. Medical, dental, law schools had similar quotas. So Jews had become accustomed to upward mobility and had surpassed other groups of immigrants, were now held back and treated like other immigrant groups. This turned Jews away from the Republican Party, which is the party of big business and management, to the Democrats, with a party of immigrants and union workers and the common man. And Jews have yet to return. In the summer of 1922, Florence Harding fell critically ill with kidney disease and was near death, and then had a miraculous recovery. And she reported, very interestingly, a near-death experience, seeing her father and other relatives, and saying that, she woke up and said this, she was in the valley of death, and she said, what counts is, what have you done for human beings? How much have you done for those you love? That's what matters there. That's good mussar. Harding embarked on a Western trip in the summer of 1923, including a visit to Alaska, which he predicted would someday become a state. Upon his return, he fell ill in Seattle. Some say it was food poisoning, others say his heart condition acted up. But he died 2 days later in San Francisco, August 2nd, 1923. It seems sudden. He was only 57, quite a young age. But Harding had suffered heart problems from the 1890s. He was weak and tired the whole trip. Looks like it was pneumonia that got him. Now, it's unfathomable, considering what followed to Harding's reputation, but when he died, the nation fell into deep mourning. Harding was very popular. Millions of people lined the tracks as his train made its way back to Washington, and he was lauded as a statesman, as the greatest commoner since Lincoln, and other accolades. So what happened? Well, within a few months after he died, the Teapot Dome scandal was revealed. His interior secretary and a few others had sold oil leases to private companies on land that Wilson had set aside for public use in exchange for thousands of dollars in bribes. Now, Harding was unaware of all this. Nonetheless, his secretary of the interior went to prison. His close friend, the Attorney General Dougherty, got off twice through hung juries, and Harding became tainted by association. Other scandals arose as well, which also tainted his legacy. While all this was going on, the bribery scandals were becoming publicized, a woman named Nan Britton wrote a salacious book claiming an affair with Harding in the White House and to be the mother of his child. Now, there's no independent corroboration of that, and intimates of Harding assert that Hart admitted to being infertile, but his reputation was dramatically changed. In the 20s, people didn't write tell-all books like this. Within a short time, Harding went from being the perception of the stabilizer of the American economy who healed the rifts of World War I and restored the nation to normalcy, to being an incompetent boob, a drinker, and a Lothario, and a crook as well. All of this a testament to the power and endurance of Lashon Hara. Now, Harding was succeeded by his vice president, Calvin Coolidge, who was never in Harding's inner circle. He was considered a paragon of virtue, a very simple, humble person. And Coolidge has also been criticized for decades, but his reputation, in fact, has improved dramatically in the last 30, even the last 15 years. So Coolidge was unfairly tainted with the Depression that began after he left office, but his stock has steadily risen. President Reagan admired him, President Bush II as well. Reagan put his portrait, Coolidge's portrait, in the cabinet room, as did Bush. And for a Republican, it doesn't get any better than this. He was honest, he cut taxes, business boomed. Coolidge is known for his statement in a speech, "The chief business of America is business. It was prosperity at home and peace abroad. What else do you want?" He was ridiculed because in a flamboyant age, he was the exact opposite. Taciturn, shy, widely known as Silent Cal. In fact, he was a great counterbalance to the hedonism of the era. And American life changed dramatically. In the 1920s already, at automated factories, with automated work, more productivity, higher wages, workers had more free time, better pay, better conditions. The Model T, which the average person could afford, enabled people to travel more. Cities expanded into the suburbs. It was an era in which the middle class began to live very, very well in the United States. Calvin Coolidge obeyed prohibition, unlike Harding. And he had what used to be considered a good trait. He never spoke unless he had something to say. Imagine that. And he had the unnerving habit of listening to someone, usually someone who wanted a favor, a political job, and just not answering, with the person leaving. Coolidge once confided to Hoover, "If you keep dead still, they'll run down in 3 or 4 minutes. Just walk out." He would sit silently for 3 or 4 minutes. And he said, "If you answer even yes or no, they will stay another 20. Now, there's some great Coolidge stories. The most famous one, at a dinner party, a woman next to him said, "I made a bet. I can get you to say more than 2 words. Coolidge said to her, "You lose." Guy calls Coolidge and says that the chairman of the New York Port Authority just died. "Can I take his place?" So Coolidge said, if it's all right with the Undertaker, it's all right with me. My favorite Coolidge aphorism, not a joke, but one that people should take to heart. He said, if you see 10 troubles down the road, 9 will fall into a ditch before you get there. So everything in proportion. Coolidge was born in 1872 in Plymouth, Vermont. Only president born on July 4th. His father was a farmer and a local politician. Coolidge attended Amherst, became a lawyer and state politician in Massachusetts, and he rose to prominence. This happens all the time. One deed, governor of Massachusetts, 1919, he called out the National Guard to stop the riots that had broken out after the Boston police went on strike. Coolidge forced them back to work under threat of firing them. Reagan, in fact, followed Coolidge's model when he fired the air traffic controllers in the early part of his term. And Coolidge said that the police have no right to strike against the... I'm sorry, he said they have no right to strike. There is no right to strike against the public safety by anybody, anywhere, anytime. And that's modeled today. Like in New York has the Taylor Law, that police cannot go on strike. So Coolidge parlayed that one act, coming out as a strike breaker, into being considered for president in 1920. After the brokered convention that selected Harding, he was the overwhelming choice for vice president. So he became president suddenly. He was vacationing in his father's home in Vermont. He was informed that Harding had died. His father was a notary public. In the middle of the night, administered to Coolidge the oath of office. According to rumor, Coolidge then went back to sleep. At first, and as was traditional, Coolidge continued Harding's policies, kept his entire cabinet, even the secretaries that were being accused of the Teapot Dome scandal. But as the investigation unfolded, the suspects resigned, all except for Howie Daugherty, and Coolidge then fired him. And then he made the office his own in his own understated way. Odd for someone who was so quiet, Coolidge was the first president to speak on radio. So millions heard him at the same time. Odder still, Coolidge held more press conferences than any other president in history. 520, about one every 2 days. And because he was so quiet, he measured every word. And so his speeches were precise and pointed and unemotional and modest. In an analysis of 22 Coolidge speeches, totaling 52,000 words, he used the word I once in 22 speeches. And just contrast that with Obama's speech after Bin Laden was killed. In a speech maybe 7-8 minutes, he used the word I about 36 times. Coolidge never gloated. He never spoke about himself. He had few friends. His wife Grace was a bit of a live wire. Coolidge became even more introverted, if such a thing is possible, after his young son died in the White House in 1924. Sad story. Calvin Coolidge Jr., 16 years old, was playing tennis with his brother on the White House tennis court that Roosevelt had put in, and he got a blister on his toe. Staph infection set in. It was a few years before penicillin would be discovered, and the bacteria spread throughout his body, and he died a week later. He was the first presidential child to die in the White House since Lincoln's son, Willie. There have been none since, except for JFK's son, Patrick, who died 2 days after birth in 1962. Well, Coolidge's grief was uncontrollable. He blamed himself. He said, if I hadn't been president, his son would not have been playing tennis on the White House court, and he could not restrain his emotions for months. He later wrote that the power and glory of the presidency ended when his son died, and he was so disconsolate that he did almost no campaigning for re-election in the months that followed. June 24, the election is just 5 months later. Coolidge had very few interactions with Jews throughout his life. Few lived in Vermont. I think there's only one famous Jew today from Vermont. And he didn't socialize much in any event. He used a PR person, the second president to do such a thing. In fact, one of the people developed the public relations industry in America, a fellow named Edward Bernays, who was an undistinguished Jew of very distinguished lineage. Distinction ended before it got to him. His great-grandfather, Chacham Isaac Bernays, was the chief rabbi of Hamburg and the Rebbe of Rav Shamshon Raphael Hirsch. His aunt, his mother, his father's sister, Martha Bernays, famously married Sigmund Freud. Chacham Bernays' granddaughter, Martha, married Freud, and it bothered for a time, because Freud did not even light candles Friday night, but she gave it up also. The entire family underwent a spiritual metamorphosis, but this Edward Bernays became close to Coolidge and helped sell him to the public because he did not have the personality that was easily sold. I was just watching this morning, actually. Again, you should look it up on YouTube. It's fascinating. Coolidge didn't campaign much in 1924, so he used film for the first time, and you could see a 5 or 6 minute speech that Coolidge gave, a campaign speech, standing, look like at his farm in Vermont. He just stands reading papers, cards one after another, barely looking at the camera, and then when he finished, he also didn't look at the camera, he just walked away, and then the camera cut. But that's how he was. Coolidge also had a relationship with Adolf Ox, who bought the New York Times in 1896. And the Times was already prominent in the 1920s. And a relation with Louis Marshall, head of the American Jewish Committee, who tried to persuade Coolidge not to sign another anti-immigration bill in 1924, along with Stephen Wise. And Coolidge just brushed them off, decided not to see them. And again, these bills were very popular. The 24 bill further restricted immigration from Eastern Europeans and Southern Europeans. Meaning who? Again, Jews and Italians, limited Africans even more, and completely banned the immigration of Arabs and Asians. That was approved by Congress overwhelmingly. Its most vocal opponent in a very, very small minority was a young Brooklyn congressman, Emanuel Seller, who had gone to serve almost 50 years in the Congress. He was in his first term then. Even though the bill had strong bipartisan support, Coolidge was blamed for it, and Jews turned against him. So in 1924, Coolidge was nominated on the first ballot. Charles Dawes, as his vice president, while the Democrat Party was in chaos, again, because Coolidge was very popular as well. It took, imagine this, and even if there's a brokered Republican convention, you hope it doesn't come to this, 103 ballots over 10 days to nominate an unknown John Davis from West Virginia, known to us because he's the named partner in Davis Polk, famous law firm in New York. In the process, for the very first time, and one reason why it took such a long time for the Democrats to find a nominee, the Ku Klux Klan was an active part and vocal participant in the nominating convention. That's because the Klan had been shut out of the Coolidge administration. So they became Democrats. With the slogan, "Keep Cool with Coolidge," Coolidge trounced Davis 54% to 29%, with a third candidate, Robert La Follette, the Wisconsin progressive, winning 17% of the vote. During the campaign, Coolidge spoke frequently on radio, rarely traveled, but people saw him because of the films that he made. For the first time on record, but not the last, Jews were on the losing side in a presidential election, supporting Davis over Coolidge, 51 to 27%, almost the mirror opposite of the national vote. And Jews have voted Democrat ever since, come what may. So it's quite strange in context that here Jews and the Ku Klux Klan, they both oppose Coolidge. But such bizarre voting patterns would recur for the next 90 years. Coolidge spoke eloquently at the laying of the cornerstone of the Washington Jewish Community Center, lauding the Jewish faith as the faith of liberty, extolling our contributions to America, and adding, every inheritance of the Jewish people, every teaching of their secular history and religious experience draws them powerfully to the side of charity, liberty, and progress. When a Supreme Court vacancy arose in 1924, Coolidge considered nominating Benjamin Cardozo to the court, but didn't, being persuaded that having two Jews on the court would be at least one Jew too many. Now, Coolidge was a great believer in the business cycle, in letting the markets determine winners and losers, and he was a model, the model of the laissez-faire president. It worked then, in contrast, in reaction to Roosevelt, to Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. Coolidge was a great believer in small and limited government. How small? Coolidge. If the federal government were to go out of existence, the common run of the people would not detect the difference. The real anchors of society were the state and local governments. The truth is, it remains true today as well. You know, when the government was shut down a few years ago, who among us really felt it? So the media had to find tourists who were shut out of national parks. But between those tourists, the only other group affected were people who received checks from the federal government. Most people don't feel the presence or helpfulness of the federal government. So if the government just kept the border safe, the country safe, the laws in force, we would do quite well. But the problem is, from Roosevelt's time on, as we'll discuss next time, the government just starts taking money from one group, giving it to another group, whether it's because of a need or because of votes, everything changes. A recent biography of Coolidge by Amity Schles sings his praises as one of America's great, if underrated, presidents, calls him the great refrainer, because he just did not do a lot of things people wanted done. And Coolidge was the only president in history to leave office with a smaller federal budget than when he took office. He just cut spending whenever he thought something unnecessary was being funded. Coolidge slashed taxes across the board, 1926, as sure as Arthur Laffer would anticipate in the 1970s, government revenue increased. Lower taxes, people more incentive to work, incomes go up, taxes paid go up, even if the rates are lower. The American economy was booming, and Coolidge took to the airwaves to laud the manufacturers whose products had bettered people's lives. Coolidge was a modest individual, deeply religious, stated without hesitation, our government rests upon religion. And he said, all the rights that Americans have and our longing for justice and equality all derive from the Bible. Coolidge did little internationally, agreed with the decision not to join the League of Nations. He did favor the U.S. joining the World Court. However, the Senate placed so many conditions that no agreement was ever reached. U.S. didn't join, and Coolidge did not press the issue. Nor did Coolidge recognize the communist Soviet Union. That would not happen until FDR's term. In 1928, trying to smooth relations with Latin America, Coolidge became the only president to date to visit Cuba, where he spoke at a conference. He did not succeed in quelling anti-American sentiment, aside from his honeymoon in Canada. It was the only time in Coolidge's life he left the U.S., and even as we speak, and I think it's 2 weeks now, President Obama will become the second president to visit Cuba. Strange coincidence, it overlaps with the AIPAC conference in Washington, so he doesn't have to attend that. Now, despite his open skepticism, Coolidge had the U.S. sign on to the Kellogg-Briand Treaty. Kellogg became the Secretary of State after Hughes. The Kellogg-Briand Treaty outlawed war as an instrument of national policy, and dozens of countries signed on. Coolidge felt, realistically, there can't be any shortcuts to peace, but since war was outlawed in 1928, there hasn't been probably a day without some conflict across the world. So Frank Kellogg did win a Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts, which is pretty much par for the course in Nobel Peace Prizes. He meant well, but the treaty did not matter within a very short time. Coolidge could have run for another term in 1928. He simply printed on a piece of paper, "I do not choose to run for president in 1928, short and sweet, handed out copies to reporters, and declined to take any questions, true to form. He later said that if he would have been reelected, he'd be in Washington for 10 years, and that's far too long for any one person. That fall, 1920, cut taxes again, and the stock market soared. Coolidge left office with the nation prosperous and peaceful, so naturally, he was criticized. Walter Lippmann, columnist, son of German Jews, intermarried twice, wrote about Coolidge, "Nobody has ever worked harder at inactivity. With such force of character, such unremitting attention to detail, with such conscientious devotion to the task." And he'd really be, maybe Hoover to an extent, the last non-activist president. Coolidge quickly returned to New England. He refused to join boards, endorse products, cash in on being a past president, saying, "These people are trying to hire not Calvin Coolidge, but a former president of the United States, and that office is not for sale." He did write a very terse autobiography, almost nothing personal in it, and he wrote a newspaper column for 1 year. He fell ill in late 1932, and he died in January 1933, before that term would have ended, age 60, weeks before FDR became president. He was still enormously popular, despite efforts to pin the depression then raging on his policies. Told Calvin Coolidge had died, the satirist Dorothy Parker said, "How could they tell?" Well, only four presidents have had the same letters as their initials. Three of the four served consecutively, but for Harding, Woodrow Wilson, Calvin Coolidge, and Herbert Hoover, Ronald Reagan is the fourth. Few presidents have been as reviled as Herbert Hoover, not without some justification, but also greatly exaggerated. Democrats for 80 years ran against Herbert Hoover. "Don't vote for generic Republican. He will be another Herbert Hoover." Roosevelt himself admitted he ran against Hoover twice and against Hitler twice. But even running against Hitler, he mentioned Hoover as well. And certainly Hoover presided over and exacerbated the worst economic catastrophe in American history. So Herbert Hoover was a Quaker, born in Iowa, 1874. First president born west of the Mississippi. Very difficult life, actually. He almost died as a child. He was revived by an uncle. Orphaned of both parents by the time he was nine. And he was extremely intelligent. He graduated Stanford as an engineer, geologist. He traveled the world, spending more time abroad, living and working, and earning a lot of money in Australia, China, England, than any president ever. He was a great, shrewd, and very somewhat heartless businessman. He built companies. He's like Mitt Romney, but without Romney's personality. He built companies, he rescued other companies, he made a fortune. By today's standards, then he was earning what today's the equivalent of several million dollars annually. He had very few friends, he spoke very little, he was a closed and a bit joyless personality, likely attributable to the poverty and loneliness in which he was raised. He usually spoke, for example, without looking at people. At age 10, right after he was orphaned, his relative in Iowa sent him across the country to Oregon to live with an uncle who once chided him for giggling. It was a very humorous life. He was a Quaker, admittedly not a very pious one, and in a word, or several words, Hoover could be haughty, overbearing, surly, tactless, and that's on his good days. People lauded his managerial skills, and they loathed him as well. After he became successful in Australia, he married his sweetheart, Lou Henry. It's a woman, not a man. 4.5 months older, but the only woman registered at Stanford when Hoover was there, and a fellow Iowan as well. And they had two sons. Now, Hoover came to international fame during World War I, and this is how he made his reputation. He was living in London when the war started and immediately organized his fellow American businessmen and arranged support for the 100,000 Americans who were fleeing the continent. But he really made his reputation by overseeing famine relief efforts in war-torn Europe, especially in Belgium and France. He literally saved millions of people from starvation. It was an extraordinary logistical operation of acquiring foodstuffs and distributing it in a humane and efficient way and under conditions of war. If you think it's simple, there's starvation until today in Africa. Notwithstanding that there's enough food in Africa, enough grain, to feed the whole continent. It's because the grain does not make it to the people. It's siphoned off and sold by the corrupt governments there. It doesn't make it to the people. Hoover was a tremendous, powerful personality, a can-do guy, great organizer. He just got things done. So he had to negotiate with the Germans, Austrians, and British and French. And nonetheless, somebody was able to do it. Hoover also raised the money privately for the relief effort, and that became one of his responses to the Depression that destroyed him. He believed that voluntarism and private charity could solve any problem. And so he hesitated at getting government involved. And for all the success, and even Wilson acknowledged him as a great international figure, he was a Quaker. He never actually sought personal credit for his deeds. Wilson created for Hoover the job of domestic food administrator. He came back to America during the war. It was the first job that he had in America in decades, and his rationing scheme ensured that no Americans went hungry. And he micromanaged. Every industry was told what to do, to the extent that he told bakers what percentage of non-wheat flour they can use in their baking. Again, after the war, Wilson sent him. He assumed a similar role in Europe, organizing and controlling the distribution of food across the continent, a massive undertaking. And he was a horse trader, a wheeler dealer. He once acquired two Austrian locomotives in exchange for 2 million Galician eggs. And that's no joke. I mean, to put the parties together, it's something. When government money ran out, he raised millions privately. So Hoover was an extraordinary talent. And people already spoke of him as a potential president. His only drawback was that as 1920 came, he still had no party affiliation. Partly because he had denounced both parties when it suited him, and partly because he hadn't lived in the United States for so long. He grudgingly became a Republican, briefly ran for president, didn't win his home state of California, the primaries, and eventually supported Harding, became Harding's Secretary of Commerce, and there he served for Harding and Coolidge until 1928, when he was the leading candidate for the Republican nomination. And again, Hoover, from the Department of Commerce, provided food to starving Russians during the Russian Civil War, whites versus reds, in the early 1920s, and by all accounts, he literally saved 9 million people from starvation. In truth, Coolidge did not much like Hoover, who was very difficult to like in any event. Coolidge called Hoover Wonder Boy, partly in derision, but also because Coolidge loved to delegate and Hoover was eminently qualified. So Hoover easily won the nomination and the election, and the election he crushed Al Smith, who was the New York governor, and the first Catholic to run for the presidency. Hoover defeated him 58-41%, 444-87 Electoral College, and Jews voted overwhelmingly for Al Smith, completely out of step with the nation, 72%-27%, almost a mirror of Carter over Ford, 71-27%, but at least Carter won. Here, Smith lost in a landslide, and the Jews voted for him in a bigger landslide. But New York was the most populous state. Jews knew Smith, and having a Catholic, also part of a detested minority in many parts of the country, was somewhat comforting. And here, the KKK was attacking Smith, and they attacked Jews as well, so Jews flocked to Smith. But Jews were not unknown to Hoover, especially wealthy Republican Jewish businessmen. So one of them, actually was young at the time when he started, Louis Strauss served as Hoover's personal secretary during the war. Hoover's right-hand man in Europe, close friend, confidant. After the war, Strauss was taken in by the banker Felix Warburg, made a fortune, campaigned for Hoover, but declined any official position. Strauss remained a close advisor to Hoover. He was an anti-Zionist, and nothing progressed on that front. Another Hoover intimate was Julius Rosenwald, who's the CEO of Sears Roebuck and Company, philanthropist who worked closely with Hoover in providing food relief, and also the aforementioned Louis Marshall, who's a lawyer and the head of the AJC. These were the most prominent Jewish Republicans, all enthusiastically supporting Hoover, with Rosenwald even predicting in 1928 Hoover would become one of the greatest American presidents. And all these Jews refused appointments. Hoover, after some initial hesitation and having overridden objections from some aides, appointed Cardozo to the Supreme Court in 1932, the Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes seat, even though there was already one Jew on the court, Brandeis, and even though Cardozo was a Democrat. Hoover simply found him the most qualified. Benjamin Cardozo was a brilliant jurist whose decisions are still studied. He was born in New York City from a Spanish-Portuguese converso family by way of the Netherlands and London. Family were members in Sherith Israel in New York. His father was a judge. Cardozo himself graduated Columbia College and law school, became a legendary state judge, and then to the Supreme Court. He wasn't at all an observant Jew, but he was heartily recommended by the deans of the law schools in Chicago, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, was approved unanimously by the Senate. So again, he was nominated in the election in 1932. A lot of chatter today about whether the president should nominate justice to fill Antonin Scalia's seat, but if you think about it, not only did Hoover nominate a Democrat, Cardozo, but he was voted in unanimously, and that's not happening to anyone. Just yesterday I read in the Wall Street Journal that Lindsey Graham said he's against having any vote on any nominee this year. He said, "My favorite person is me. And if Obama nominated me, I would vote against myself." That's how he feels about it. Only Justice James McReynolds, who never said a word to Brandeis in 20 years together, pleaded with Hoover, I quote, "not to afflict the court with another Jew." Well, you can't satisfy everyone, and Hoover appointed Cardozo nonetheless. Hoover also became the first president since Teddy Roosevelt to invite blacks to the White House. And even earlier, when he bought a house in Washington, he refused to sign the very common restrictive covenant that barred resale to blacks or Jews. And the covenant was taken out of the deed. It's inescapable that Hoover will always be associated with the Great Depression, which happened on his watch. Whether or not it was avoidable is debated until today, as is Hoover's responses to it, both early and late. In short, the consensus is that he did not respond fast enough, preferring passivity, and when he did respond, he made poor choices. What should be beyond debate is that the Great Depression was unpredictable, or better said, it's predictable in hindsight, like many things. The problem was, America was prospering in the roaring 20s as never before. In 1929, after taking office, Hoover asserted, "America is close to the final triumph over poverty than ever before in the history of any land. The poorhouse is vanishing from among us." Andrew Mellon, Treasury Secretary, "the high tide of prosperity will continue." All ironic in retrospect. They were wrong big time. But to blame Coolidge for the Depression, or even Hoover for that matter, is to blame them for not being clairvoyant, for not overriding both the expert and majority opinion of economic governance. Had he been clairvoyant, there would have been measures that could have been taken, but economic downturns are always hard to predict. Even people, Even now, there are people who say they predicted the Great Recession of 2007, which was also foreseeable in retrospect, you know, a housing bubble. But there are people who always predict economic collapses, like they predict plane crashes every single day. Occasionally, they're correct. Right, Jean Dixon made her reputation by predicting that JFK would be killed. But she also predicted Nixon would beat JFK. Nobody remembers that. Someone's always predicting something, and sometimes they're right. One of my most favorite professors in college ever, William Luchtenberg, one of the great scholars of FDR, the New Deal, called his book about this era, the 20s, The Perils of Prosperity. We had to read it in the course also. And prosperity certainly has its perils as well. Osher is also a nisayon, just like Oni is a nisayon. It's just a nisayon, it's a trial of a different nature. The Depression was a perfect storm that destroyed Hoover. If anything, if it could be believed, Hoover was a colder personality than even Coolidge. And so he could never project the sunny optimism, even amid bad things happening, that FDR was able to do. The stock market crashed October 24th, 1929. Tuesday, October 29th, was even worse. Billions of dollars in assets were lost overnight. We could discuss the cause of the Depression for weeks and not come to a definitive conclusion. Suffice it to say, the value of assets was inflated, the money supply was too tight, government did next to nothing to stimulate the economy, and Hoover remained a great believer almost to the end in the ability of the private sector charity to cope with hardship. So he acted first by rallying the business community to maintain wages, even if sales were down, because you maintain wages, you maintain consumer earning potential, and so it worked for a time, even if not every business complied. So Hoover understood, and this is so ironic also in retrospect, America had weathered its first five depressions by the government doing nothing, or very little. That was the minute, so he endeavored to do the same. Those depressions were called panics. 1819, 1837, 1873, 1893, the panic of 1893. So ironically, it was Hoover who called this downturn the Depression, which he felt was a more upbeat description of what was going on. Because he meant it, and again, here's the engineer's mind, a guy without any emotional intelligence. He didn't mean depression in terms of despondency. He meant depression in terms of a small indentation in a flat surface, a dip, an indentation. That's how he meant it. See, he was tone deaf. What he called the Depression made people feel even worse about it. And even though the market picked up after the crash, the New York Times did not even consider the crash the major story of 1929, if you think about it. Unemployment increased, followed by homelessness and hunger and depression in all its aspects. Hoover did not have the temperament to deal with it effectively. An agency created to bail out the banks angered people, much as in recent times as well. Because the people weren't being helped. Banks did not relax their lending policies, even once they had more capital, shades of our recent problems as well. A drought across the Midwest in 1930 devastated those states. And the one act Congress took, increasing tariffs to help local industry, boomeranged, because trade and export suffered as well. Factory output dropped precipitously. Hoover kept saying the problems are behind us, and again, in such an inelegant way, he announced one day, people complained things are tough, he said, even the hobos are better fed than they ever have been. Not the most encouraging statement. In truth, the economy was improving by 1931 and into the election year of 1932, and FDR's contributions are still hotly debated. But because he was such a dominant personality, people don't recall that conditions worsened on FDR's watch, and by 1937, the country's in a worse state than even 1932. Higher unemployment, more suffering. Well, Hoover left office in 1933, but Roosevelt's such an optimistic personality that people sense he knew what to do. Hoover expected to win re-election in 1932. At first, he was happy to run against Roosevelt, whom he considered a lightweight. Well, Hoover was trounced. No sitting president was ever trounced as soundly. Hoover went from winning 40 states in 1928 to winning just 6 in 1932, and not even his home state, and he was despised. People called for his impeachment right after the election. Others wanted him to be hanged. Roosevelt refused to cooperate with him in the interregnum, angering Hoover even more. Towards the end of his term in 1933, banks started to collapse. The country was ready to disintegrate. To FDR, Hoover was a good act to follow, meaning you can't do worse. He's already so reviled. To Hoover, he said, democracy is a harsh employer. And he never understood how things went so wrong or why he was to blame. No matter, Hoover remains a scapegoat, although there's a rich revisionist history that acknowledges his mistakes, but also sees how FDR compounded the problem with the New Deal, besides altering the very premises of our government, but that's for next time. Hoover traveled to Europe in the 1930s, the late 30s. In Europe, they still lionized him. He even met Hitler in the late 30s, but after someone in their group mentioned Jews, Hitler stood up, unleashed an unhinged tirade against Jews that went on for several minutes until Hoover interrupted him curtly and said, "Sit down, that's enough. I'm not interested in your views." He lived another 30 years after he left office, eventually being rehabilitated by Harry Truman, who disliked the way FDR had blamed Hoover for his own mistakes. He blamed everything that happened on Hoover. Hoover lived longer than any president except for Adams, a record now held by Ronald Reagan, who lived to be 94, the same age at which Nancy died yesterday. And Hoover had the longest post-presidency of any president until Jimmy Carter. It's now 35 years. Hoover lived 31 years or so after he left office. His latter years, he was in a wheelchair. He was hard of hearing, such that his secretaries had to shout in his ear so he should hear them. When someone objected, Hoover said, "That's all right. I'm used to being hollered at." 1964, when Hoover died, LBJ eulogized him as one of the unluckiest men ever to serve as president. And we know life needs a share of mazel as well. So three presidents we discussed tonight have not been judged favorably by history, even if Harding's term was cut short before he was tainted by scandal, even if Coolidge's term was marked by peace and prosperity, can't get any better, and even if Hoover's responsibility for the Depression is somewhat exaggerated, but that history was written largely by acolytes of their successor, FDR. FDR took office March 4th, 1933, with the country on the verge of a breakdown. He'd become one of the great presidents of the 20th century, but also one of the most complicated. His relationship with Jews and his record during the Holocaust is controversial until today. Jews idolized him. For what and whether it was deserved, we'll discuss next time. I thank you all very much.